Blog Talk Radio.
923, I'll give you a corrected address, but you have a fire in a one story ordinary. Looks like it's about 40 by 120, 125. Get your traffic control. Squad 5, squad 5. Over to 273, 273.
Hi, this is Dr. Beth Murphy, and I am here tonight in beautiful El Paso, Texas, and I am here to talk to you about topics in firefighter behavioral health. And for any of you who happen to have logged on, I apologize. I had technical difficulties, and I had to deal with a small child. So as some of you may know, I am a clinical psychologist in private practice and a retired firefighter. I'm also married to John Murphy, who did his show with, he does a fire service court with Chip Comstock, Kurt Barone, and Brad Pinsky. And I understand that this week they talked about presumptive illness, particularly cancer, and the cancer being on the rise, and more cancer and illnesses becoming presumptive. And so he had asked me if I would talk about kind of the mental health aspect of getting that type of diagnosis and going through that whole process. So that is one of the topics, or the main topic, that we're going to talk about tonight. I did want to take a few minutes to speak about like trusting departmental behavioral health resources, because this is a question that I get often. It's not necessarily, well, it's a question that kind of goes along with talking about employee assistance programs. And so I was just going to touch on that, because I've gotten a question via email about how to help your department members trust department set up behavioral health programs. Sometimes that is the employee assistant program, but sometimes the departments have set up another type of behavioral health program to support their members, where they may have worked with a clinical psychologist or other mental health professional to set that up. And so there sometimes is a lot of distrust around that. So when an employer is involved in setting up that type of support system, there can be distrust. And a common thing that might be said is, well, this is just a way, you know, what about confidentiality? And this is just a way to get rid of me. I'm struggling and I need to go get help, and I go through the departmental resources, then they're going to find out, meaning administration, and I'm going to lose my job. And so that's a fear that I've heard several times from a lot of different people. Sometimes it comes from the fact that there is a sharing of information that should not be happening. And other times it is coming from a person who's gone through their department process and getting help, and the department hadn't really worked out the kinks of the program that they created, and so people didn't really know what the steps were. So I wanted to just talk about then, how do you develop trust in those department-placed behavioral health programs? And that it really honestly extends to other programs. I know that when there was that big push for physical health and developing that peer network and ensuring that members were physically healthy, that also was met with a lot of resistance. This is just a way to get rid of us. And I know that in my department, they contracted with an organization to provide comprehensive assessment, physical assessment. And it was for the benefit of the department members, but most of the people were very leery and they thought that information would get back to the department that could cost them their job. And the fact is that it actually helped a lot of people. But the evaluation that they were doing was, comprehensive blood work, physical fitness, body fat measuring, ability, trying to think of all what was involved, but basically it was everything. It was comprehensive and the department paid for it. And and just because they had contracted with this agency, it didn't mean that the agency ignored confidentiality. So if anything came up in the testing, it was up to the firefighter or the department member to share that with the department, which, as you can imagine, most people wouldn't. But it actually helped when, and I don't know if your department is like ours, but in our department, we did annual fitness evaluations. And essentially, that was a mini version of the entry-level fitness. So it was just meant to ensure that we were still capable of doing the job. And for us to see, are we decreasing in fitness or increasing in fitness, like where were we? But the department, from their perspective, it was just to make sure that we could do our job. And so I know that there were people who had some like heart rate issues. They were using a formula for a max rate heart rate, and as you age, that max rate heart rate goes down if you're using just the baseline formula to figure out what your max rate heart rate is. And it doesn't account for the differences between men and women, because there is, and then there's differences with aging. So it doesn't account for any of that stuff. And so the fitness program that the department sponsored, paid for us, actually allowed members who struggled on meeting that max heart rate standard, allowed them to go to this facility, this organization, and to actually have their max heart rate measured. And so that max heart rate may actually show up to be higher. And whereas if you use just the straight formula, that would tend to put you at the low end, particularly as you aged. So it actually was a very good thing for members. And like I said, the information was confidential, but there was a lot of distrust for that. And what made the difference was the department supported it. They answered questions of the members when the members were questioning, how is this information going to be used? Who's going to have access to it? The union was supportive of it, and it was actually the union members that went through the process of the evaluation before anybody else did. And then there were a lot of well-respected firefighters, fire officers that went. That developed a lot of trust in the program. And so the behavioral health programs then that the departments are putting in place, it kind of is the same thing. People are questioning, what are you going to do with this information? What information is shared? What about confidentiality? And so people are really worried about confidentiality. And so the best thing to do, if you're trying to build trust in that type of program, or you have that type of program and you're concerned about utilizing it and who's going to know, then ask questions. So asking questions and getting answers to those questions is really important. So know what the program is. Ask specifically about who gets to know what you talk about. What information is shared, if any? And then who's gone through it? Well, they wouldn't tell you who's gone through it, but you can ask. You can ask your coworkers. You could ask. You can ask people if they've utilized that particular service. And if you are part of the union or you're part of the group within the department that developed this program, then you need to post the information. You need to talk about the information. And you and any other member that had a hand in developing it, you should be the first that uses that program. Because you don't have to be ready to walk off the job to get benefit from a behavioral health program. Just making it be a little stressful, and with all the other stressors that you are exposed to, then getting a little extra help, having somebody who's a sounding board, it would be helpful. So you don't have to be in extreme distress to reach out and get some assistance. And so if you are well-respected in your department, if you were part of developing this program, then be the first person to use it and be willing to talk about it. So it's the things that we don't know and we don't understand, that's what we're afraid of. And that's true of anybody, even psychologists. So bottom line, to develop trust in any program, it needs to be transparent. Transparent in the respect that information about the program is provided to the people who you want to use the program. And then confidentiality, you need to ensure that the program is going to be confidential. I heard from one particular department that had an employee assistance program that was set up that ported back to the department itself as to who used their services and why. And I find that when I first heard this, I said, there's no way. There is no way that would happen. But they insisted that, yes, it does happen, and nobody will use it because it gets back to the department, and then they have something written in their operating procedures that would allow the department to fire them, apparently. So nobody wants to get help through the department. And that's only one case that I've heard of. Most of the other departments that I have talked with, they have programs that are departmental resources, whether it's the employee assistance program or a behavioral health program, that does honor confidentiality, and it is encouraged that members use it. And what gets reported back to the department is how many people use it, and that would be appropriate, because if you put you put a lot of money into a department, and you put time, you put effort, you put money. You want your members to use it. And so you want to know that it's being used, because if it's not being used, then you need to look at, well, what's going on? Why isn't it being used? How can we change this? So anyway, I hope that answers that question that comes up about developing, trusting department instituted behavioral health programs. And there's a range of what those might be, but that trust is important because you want members to utilize those services. And you want to know when they're not utilizing them. so that you can find out why and you can change it. So that was just my little spiel on building trust. So talk about it, make sure you ask questions and it gets answered. Make sure that trusted members of the department go through the program first. Have union members go through the program and have them be willing to talk about it. So, and I know that behavioral health is one of those things that we still don't want to talk about, and it creates a lot of embarrassment and shame. But it really doesn't have to be that way. Everybody struggles. And that's the message that I keep saying. So, so that's that. So now I'm going to kind of switch gears a little bit. So if anybody listened to Fire Court Radio, which I have to be, or Fire Court Radio, I'll be honest, I hadn't listened to it, but I had talked to my husband and he said, you know, we really missed out on talking to people about, you know, what to do, like what to do if you get that diagnosis of cancer. So, you know, when you get the news of having a cancer and what kind of resources are available to you, how do you cope with it? And there actually is a lot to that. And so I know that they talked about the legal aspect of presumptive illnesses. And so I'm not going to talk about that because obviously the legal aspect I'm not really clear on. But I know that if you have questions about that, you can obviously listen to Fire Service Court Radio, listen to John Murphy and Chip Comstock. They were the two that were talking about it. You can also go to the IAFF.org, and they have a section on presumptive illness disability law. And so you can actually look at that and understand your rights, and it lists by state the illnesses that are considered presumptive, and that list is actually increasing. And so they actually, and I was just scanning through it, and so it looks like they actually offer assistance in helping you get your illness to be considered as presumptive as well. And so this is important if you can't work and you want to retire, or not want to, but you have to retire because of this illness. And so if it is deemed as presumptive, then you get your disability, for that. So that's like the extent of my legal expertise on all this. And I know that when they talked about two people that I actually worked with in my department, and they both developed malignant melanomas, and they had to fight to have that declared as a presumptive illness. And it was something I hadn't realized because when I was there, I don't know if they were affected yet. And then after I left, it was something that they kind of kept quiet, but they fought it and they did win their case. So so the IAFF.org has some really great information for you about your rights, and it sounds like some assistance if needed to have your illness be considered presumptive. So now it's like we're talking about like a physical illness. So we're talking most often about cancer. Cancer is more and more prevalent, and you may be thinking, well, why is somebody who deals with behavioral health talking about something that affects us physically? Well, the fact is that having cancer can really turn your world upside down, and it impacts you. Mentally, psychologically, cognitively, spiritually even. So it impacts you in all areas, in all ways as possible. Part of my internship, actually my whole internship, was working with cancer patients and their families. And I can tell you that there's a lot of psychology that goes on when somebody hears the word cancer, not just for the individual who is directly impacted by it, but also family members. And so I guess the first thing is like, what happens when you're getting the news? And I can tell you from the experience that I've had in working with cancer patients and their families, the first time that somebody hears the word cancer, it's like their ears close. It's like they don't hear anything else. It's like cancer is just, it just drums through their brain and pushes out any other information that gets in. And so that's why it's really important that if you have something suspicious going on and you're thinking that this is something that could be bad, it's like, don't go to your doctor visit alone. Take somebody with you. Because you need somebody who can hear what you can't. And I don't care who you are. It's like every single person that I have ever talked to that has received a diagnosis of cancer, they all have said that when they heard the word cancer, they didn't hear anything else. And so then they walk out of their doctor's appointment with all sorts of questions. And so what I would say is that when you start down this road, get used to taking a notebook with you and write down your questions. It's much better to write your questions when you're not in the doctor's office, because your brain is not going to be working as well. So, we have a lot of beliefs around cancer, and one belief that is really difficult for people to kind of push aside is the idea that cancer is a death sentence. And cancer is not a death sentence. It doesn't have to be. In many cases, it's not. And yes, unfortunately, there are still cancers that do result in death. And it can be dependent on like when it gets diagnosed, what kind of treatments, or even the type of cancer. So some cancers are more treatable and have a much better prognosis than others. And I'm sure that you probably, in your experiences as a firefighter and in your job with family members, with friends, you probably know what cancers people survive and what cancers tend to shorten people's lives. So you have some knowledge, but it doesn't matter having that knowledge, because it's just not there. It's not ready for your brain when you hear the word cancer. So if this is news that you're going to be getting, or you suspect you're going to get it, then don't go it alone. Important that you have somebody with you. And then don't be afraid to ask questions, and don't be afraid to get second opinions or even a third opinion. There are doctors have different ideas about different treatments. And so if you can't be your own advocate, then make sure you have somebody with you who can advocate for you, who understands you and your wishes and can speak out. And I know, I mean, I'm talking to firefighters, so of course you would speak out, or maybe you wouldn't. Sometimes we kind of revert back a little bit, and it can be helpful to have somebody that is like taking care of us in a way. And so having somebody fight your battles for you, and sometimes getting the care that you need or understanding the care that you need requires a little bit of a fight, because your fight is about fighting to get well, fighting the cancer. You want to be healthy. So that's your fight. And so having somebody else that can fight with the doctors just about your care and getting the information you need, that can help a lot. So you have to be willing and able to pick your battles and then have somebody with you to battle the other things that you can't. So that's where, how I think about, you know, getting the news. So, and if you get, you get the news that you have cancer, then definitely get a second opinion, and get that second opinion before you decide to do any type of treatment. The other thing is, don't get really hung up on percentages or the statistics. You have to understand that most of the statistics in general, the statistics that are offered to you, are at least 5 years old. So those statistics come from studies, and from the time that the study starts and ends, and then it is evaluated, written about, and published, it's about 5 years, and sometimes it can be longer. So it's good to know the statistics, but it, don't get hung up on those numbers, because a lot changes, and it rapidly changes in the medical field as it concerns cancer. So, and I might come back to this in a little bit. So now you got the diagnosis. And so if you're like me, the first thing you're going to do is go to the internet and Google it. So I would say, well, I'm not going to tell you not to do it, but I'm going to tell you to make sure that when you Google information about your condition, make sure it's reputable. And so one of the go-to resources that I used when I worked with cancer patients and their families was to go to the American Cancer Society. So their webpage is cancer.org, and their phone number is 800-227-2345. And so for general information about cancer, that's a great place to go. So they're not really going to discuss particulars with you because they can't. Each person can be can vary a little bit in their experience of their particular cancer, but they can talk about kind of the general stuff. And they can also help you formulate questions that you can ask your doctor. And anybody that you get, like if you call, anybody that you get, should be telling you, write that down, you should ask your doctor. So your doctor is going to be the first part of your care team. And with cancer, you really do have a team. And so you want to develop the best team that you can. And you may have a lot of control over this, or you may have a little control over this. But where... don't be afraid to speak up for yourself. So the American Cancer Society is a good place to go. And then, again, you can go to IAFF.org and it will give you some links, but there's also the Firefighter Cancer Support Network, which can provide some support. And you can find them at firefightercancersupport.org, or you can find it through the IAFF website. But that can be a good resource. The American Cancer Society, I think, is good for getting that general information. And then I think going to the Firefighter Cancer Foundation is a place to go when you're wanting more individualized, connected support, if you will. Hopefully that makes sense. So I know that when people come to see me for behavioral health issues, people, firefighters, they come to me because they say that I get it, because I was a firefighter. I know what the culture's like. I know the stressors that exist. I know the schedule, so I understand it. And so people come see me because of that. And so there's a lot of I don't want to say it's not trust, but bond a little bit faster. And so being able to connect with other people who are struggling with cancer, who are in the fire service, I think is also really important. I was also looking, you can find information also on the IAFC website. And they also refer back to the Firefighter Cancer Support Network. So there's support out there. And so it's just reaching out. So if you're looking for that initial support or resource, then those are good places to go and to help you formulate questions, because there's going to be a lot that you're not going to know. So, and then again, I may come back to some of this. It may circle back. The other thing, so now this is like kind of going back to getting the news, but also the process of just kind of taking it in and becoming, I guess, wrapping your brain around it. It's not unusual, or let's say it's even normal, to experience a lot of different emotions. And so a lot of the writing around cancer and receiving that diagnosis, they talk about experiencing the five stages of grief. And this is not like you experience these things in order. And it's not necessarily just the five things, but it's five things with like subcategories that happen. And it's kind of all over the place. It's a mess. But the five stages in general of grief is the denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And then, like I said, there's a whole lot of other things that happen in between those. Those are just the main categories. And it doesn't happen in a nice, neat, linear fashion. So you might start out with denial, like there's no way that I have cancer. And that may even be starting before you ever get diagnosed. You might be experiencing some symptoms that are concerning, but you're ignoring it and telling yourself you're fine, it's okay, there's nothing wrong, you'll go back to normal. And so that denial can even start before you ever get diagnosed, but it's like that first spark in your brain that signals that something really serious might be wrong. That's when the denial might start. But these stages are something that most everybody goes through, and they may hit on each one of them or they may not. And so it's not like you're going to develop any severe psychopathology if you don't experience every one of these. But I know with the cancer patients that I've worked with, I've seen each one of these things in them. And they can cycle back. So I've seen people go back and forth to denial. I've seen people reach a level of acceptance and then get really angry and then bargain. And so it's kind of a messy process. But it's normal. And that's the thing, is that there's a lot of things that you're going to experience when you get a diagnosis of cancer. And a lot of it is normal. So the question is, then, what might not be normal? And what might not be normal is going to be kind of to you. So everybody's going to act a little bit differently. But some of the things that might signal that there's a little bit more going on, and that maybe getting a little bit of help or being able to talk and vent about this would be like feeling overwhelmed, like very anxious and panicky. So having panic attacks might signal that this is a little bit more than a normal response. Developing a sense of dread. And that one's a hard one to describe. But so maybe dread, maybe a sense of impending doom, like being stuck in quicksand and you can't get out. That one can be experienced in a lot of different ways. Unusually irritable and angry. I mean, it's okay to be angry. If you were just diagnosed with cancer, then you can be angry and you can be a little irritable. And if you've been diagnosed and you're going through treatment now, then you will be a little bit irritable. And anger may be part of that, or you may just be irritable because you're going to be more tired. You're going to be depleted. And so irritability is something to be expected. But if it's extreme, then that also signals that there might be a problem. Difficulties in making decisions. So like I said, you know, getting a cancer diagnosis, that kind of changes your worldview. And so that change can also affect how you think and how you process things. And so that can be normal, but again, like too much might not be. And you may be, if you've listened or read, if you've listened to me before, or you've listened to anybody talk about behavioral health issues, then you may notice that some of these things that signal an extreme distress where you may want help also are similar to what somebody who's struggling with depression might experience. And so there's overlap there. And so depression, anxiety, distress, these things may be actually kind of a normal response to being diagnosed with cancer and going through the cancer treatment. So it's not an easy process. So difficulty making decisions. Also, if you're going through chemo, there's a thing called chemo brain, where that does impact your ability to make decisions and your memory, and it kind of creates a little bit of a fog, and that actually is pretty normal for treatment. And every patient that I ever interacted with talked about having this chemo brain, and most people were able to kind of process through it over time. It can stick around for quite a while. But it doesn't have to be there all the time. But it could be part of the process, part of what the chemo does to fight the cancer. And so seeing some of these changes that happen can actually free you. It can free you a lot of energy so that you can take care of yourself in other ways. And then you can do some things to kind of combat it. And so it may be that you have to develop some strategies that will help you remember things. Trouble sleeping. So that's something that's really common with depression, but also, the worry that comes with a diagnosis of cancer and what that might mean. Again, cancer is not a death sentence, but it does change your worldview. Thinking of cancer all the time or most of the time, or even thinking about death. Because, again, most people associate cancer with death, and it doesn't have to be. So some people think more about, like, this illness is going to kill me than, well, I'm going to get through this illness and I'm going to figure out how to live. And so that's where it's helpful to talk with a mental health professional, because they can help you identify that thinking that is bringing you down and switch it to not necessarily positive thinking, but to something that might be more realistic, not a lot, but a bit more future focused in a more positive way. Family conflicts can develop, and that the dynamic in the family can change in a way that would definitely need some type of intervention, because the person with cancer may shut family out because they don't want to be a burden to them, or the family members may, like, try and do too much and start to baby the person with cancer, there's a tendency to kind of overcare sometimes. So it's finding that balance. And so talking to a behavioral health specialist can help find that balance. Feeling useless or worthless, cancer treatment can take a lot out of you. And it's like you're not the same person anymore, and it may be difficult to remember the person that you were or to even imagine the type of person you will be when you get through the cancer treatment. And I know a lot of times with the people with cancer that I worked with, we talked a lot about the new normal. So what is it going to be like? Because life will not be the way it was before. And that's probably one of the biggest things that a person who has received a cancer diagnosis and is undergoing treatment, that's one of the biggest things that they need to think about. And that is, what is life going to be like, and understanding that it's not going to be the same. I can see I just got a caller, so I'm going to say this one little piece in general, and then I will answer. But there's distress in all areas of your life. So there's the practical areas where we're talking about like housing, insurance, financial issues, work issues, transportation issues, childcare, family issues. So with your significant other and or children, or maybe even some extended family, and maybe close friends, emotional issues, so the worry, the fear, the sadness, depression, nervousness, that grief or shame, and then sometimes spiritual issues. So if you're someone that attends church regularly, you may find yourself questioning your faith a lot, and that may be something really important. So before we talk any more about that, then I'm going to go to this caller. You're on the air.
Hello, this is Jeff.
Hi.
Hello? Hi. How's it going?
How are you? Good.
Good.
Can I do for you?
First question is, are we talking about firefighting still, or did we change the topic here?
Still firefighters. It's firefighters and cancer diagnosis.
Okay. Oh, wow. What a wide variety there. My question is about firefighting, if you have a second to talk about that.
Sure. Ask the question. Yeah.
Sure. It involves specifically you two ladies tonight. Do you have to be a pussy-eating dyke to be a woman firefighter? Or do you have to be a asshole-licking man to be a firefighter as a male? I'm not sure. And I would love to know, because generally all the women and males I know who are firefighters are lesbian cunts or gay-ass fucking pussies. So is that true, or am I just way off base with the way I judge people?
Well, I'm going to say that you're way off base.
Are you a lesbian? That's all I want to know, like right now. Are you a lesbian?
You obviously didn't listen. You didn't listen to the beginning of the show then.
I didn't lesbian?
Listen.
Listen.
Yeah. So you're
a lesbian?
Appropriate discussion. Not an appropriate discussion.
Do you like sucking pussy as much as I do?
Okay, so I seriously need my screener who helps me, who would be my husband, who usually runs the dashboard, and it's kind of sad for me. So I apologize to anybody that's going to be listening to this. So I'm going to finish off the show just talking about a few coping strategies. I kind of filtered a few things in there when I was talking about the dealing with the cancer diagnosis. So these are some coping strategies. So I will say that first off is that firefighters are a very resilient group of people. And so the first thing to remember is to use the coping strategies that you have used in the past that have helped you. These things will help you. Take it one day at a time also. And so I did mention before that sometimes it's useful to think about like the future you, like what will you do? So it's good to have something you can look forward to, but don't get so focused on what the future will be like. So take it that one day at a time. Use support and self-help groups. So I mentioned that obviously there's the American Cancer Society for some resources. Going through the Firefighter Cancer Support Network can help put you in touch with other firefighters and fire officers who have struggled or, you know, have been diagnosed and gone through their own cancer battle. And so that's a great support network. And then if you are a caregiver, if you're the significant other or the child of someone that has been diagnosed with cancer, you can get support as well. So most groups that offer support networks for individuals who have been diagnosed with cancer also have support for family members, caregivers, children of, close family members. Use the support networks if they make you feel better. So I've heard from some people who have been involved in support networks that felt that it was very useful to begin with, but then it might bring them down. And so if you find that the support groups are not helping you, don't be afraid to kind of back out of it for a while. And you can always go back. So it really is about what is useful for you. Find a doctor or team that encourage you to ask your questions. So it's important that you get your questions answered and that they're willing to take the time to answer them. So I know that sometimes a doctor may not be the person that is answering all the questions. Maybe it is his or her nurse or administrative assistant or something. But you need to get your questions answered. So don't be afraid to ask your questions. Don't be afraid to, like, switch doctors if you are not getting what you need or if they're not providing you with a person who can provide those needs. So you will have a lot of questions, and that's normal. Create a notebook where you can keep all your records associated with your diagnosis with doctors, because it almost always there's more than one doctor involved. You will have a team, and so you want the names and numbers of all those people, and you want them in a notebook. Also, keep your records of any labs that you have, x-ray scans, the symptoms you may experience, side effects, medications. So you want all this information in one place. And sometimes cancer treatment centers have these books already to go with dividers that are already labeled with these things. So ask about that, or you can make your own. Consider keeping a journal. The journal is not something that you have to keep forever. Writing down your thoughts, your fears, anything that's going through your head. It's a useful thing, and you don't have to keep them. You can get rid of it when you're done, or you can keep it. It's up to you. It's whatever's useful. And then exercise, whatever level of exercise you can do. Maybe it's just walking around the block. that's okay. It's important that you keep moving. Some don'ts, I guess, if you will, is to not get caught up on the idea that cancer is a death sentence. Cancer is not a death sentence. So remind yourself of that. Don't get hung up on the statistics. As I said earlier, they're generally 5 years behind. Don't suffer in silence. Cancer should not be fought alone. And so you have your coworkers. So you have this wonderful built-in support network. A woman that I worked with in the fire service, she had breast cancer and she actually fought it twice. And her crew and pretty much everybody in the department rallied around her. And they helped her. I don't know if anybody's familiar with the Columbia Tower climb. She'd been doing it every year, and this one year she was not able to do it on her own. And so her crew went with her, and they actually carried her up part of the way. And so it allowed her to complete it that year. And it was a wonderful show of support, and it's support that is built in, and it's not something that many other job occupations afford. So that support is really important, and so being willing to talk to other people. Don't avoid getting help from a mental health practitioner. So hopefully what you gleaned from some of this was that you don't have to go it alone, and that there are some things that may come up for you that it would be useful to talk to a mental health practitioner, and they might help you utilize your own resilience, your own resources, to better help yourself. And then don't abandon regular treatment for alternative treatment. Most of the research on alternative treatments that show the greatest success are typically in conjunction with regular treatment. So you undergo some, this kind of the standard treatment protocol, but then the alternative treatments come in and they can help. They can help you. They can help you with the side effects. They can help you feel better. So again, it's part of that team approach. And then I guess I'll finish with, from the mental health perspective, honor all your feelings. There's a tendency to be positive or to think you have to be positive. So I have worked with people that didn't want to talk about anything bad, nothing negative. They didn't want to bring their positive energy down. So it's more important to understand that you're going to have a multitude of emotions, and they're all valuable, and you just need to acknowledge them and then move on. So you can still essentially keep a positive attitude, but acknowledge that you have sad days, that you are angry sometimes. So you can acknowledge those, and I'm doing air quotes, negative feelings. So you don't have to be positive all the time. Sometimes you can be whatever it is that you're feeling, and don't feel like you have to apologize for it. Don't think you have to do it all yourself. Let others help you. I know I'm talking to a bunch of firefighters, and asking for help is probably the hardest thing that you ever have to do or would ever want to do. And so this is the time where you need to ask for what you want, what you need from other people. And then if you happen to be the other person, I would say, don't ask what you can do for the individual that has cancer. And also, saying, I'll be there if you call, anything you need. It's like, that's good. But think about what your talents are and what you can offer. So rather than ask what you can do, offer what you can do. So if you are a good cook, then just say, I'm going to cook you a week's worth of meals, or I'm going to cook you one or two meals, and I'm going to bring it over. You can offer to mow their lawn. You can offer to do whatever is within your area of talent and your time constraints. So offer those things. You could say, well, I can take your kids to baseball and soccer on Saturday so you can rest. Or I can go with you and I can manage the kids while you just rest and enjoy the game. Whatever that is. So offer what you can do. And pretty much it. I was just going to reiterate that you should have somebody with you when you go to the doctor and you need to take down some important information. Make sure you have something to write with. Having a person to come to act as a secondary backup memory, if you will, is useful. And don't be afraid to ask your questions. So I think that's it. And hopefully I touched on as much as I could and I answered any questions. If you have any other questions, please feel free to contact me. And you can email me at blmurphy63@mac.com. Please do email if you have any questions. So that's it for tonight. Thank you for listening. I apologize for the late start and my technical difficulties, and I apologize for my my one caller in the middle, which I probably should have hung up on right away. But thank you again, and I look forward to seeing and talking to many of you at FDIC this year. All right, good night, and take care.